HD Smartcast. You are listening to a Mint production.
Hi, I'm Shrudijit. I'm a Delhi-based journalist and the editor-in-chief of Mint. And this is The Sketch. The story of higher education in India is a concerning one, with more misses perhaps than hits. Since independence, apart from the IITs and IIMs and a few central universities, few institutions of note have come up. Indian universities are missing from the list of top 100 universities in the world, and only about 24 or so feature in the top 1,000. China, on the other hand, has made impressive gains in these rankings. It's also a matter of concern that a large number from those who benefit from subsidized education at our few world-class institutions tend to immigrate and settle in the rich economies of the West. An interesting development in this regard in the last decade or so has been the emergence of a number of private universities that aspire to world-class standards, especially in the liberal arts. The most notable project among them has been the Ashoka University, based in Sonipat near Delhi. What makes Ashoka interesting is that it is funded by a large number of philanthropists, making it impossible for any one person or a small group to control the university. We will hear more about what makes the university special and what plans are afoot for the next phase in its journey from my guests today, who are among the founding trustees of the university, Pramod Raj Sinha and Ashish Dhawan. Both are remarkable individuals and institution builders. Pramod was the founding dean of the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad. He used to be a partner at McKinsey and has worked as the CEO of Anand Bazar Patrika. He runs his own media venture, 9.9 Media, and has now founded Harappa Education. Ashish Dhawan is the founder of Chris Capital and has channeled his early success in private equity into a slew of social impact projects. Most notable is the Central Square Foundation, which also does a lot of work in education. He is one of India's top philanthropists and is now working to encourage and help other high net worth individuals to give back meaningfully. I hope to talk to them today about what ails Indian higher education, their learnings from the building of Ashoka University, and about how philanthropy can be channeled into institution building. Pramod and Ashish, thanks for joining us today and welcome to The Sketch.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Pramod, let me come to you first. I want to talk about what ails Indian higher education. What are the top two or three factors you think are important in this regard?
We are going to be here till the cows come home, as they say, if we are going to talk about this. I think, very simply, we haven't been able to get quality education to as many people as we need to in India. So both in terms of numbers and in terms of quality, we have a huge deficit. And while there are a few high quality institutions, and they do give us good graduates, they go around the world and have earned a name for us, the truth is that even those high quality institutions have not been able to keep up with the best in the world,
right?
So many years after they were founded. So we have reasonable quality for a few people, but we certainly don't have top quality compared to global levels. And we have it, any education, we still have it for very few people, given our GER numbers.
Right. Can you explain GER?
Right. So GER is just gross enrollment ratio. And what you look at is, for a particular age of people or population, the numbers of people who are actually going to college or to school relative to how many should be in school or college. So if you have 25 million kids being born every year, you would argue that there are about 100 million college-going youth, you know, if you take a four-year window.
Right.
And of that, today, our official numbers are that about 26-27%. So one in every four is actually enrolled in college,
right,
in the 18 to 22-year-old age group. That's the GER.
And how does that compare with, say, China and the United States?
Those are way upwards in 60-70%. I don't know exactly the numbers, but most economies are in the advanced economies or even developing economies are in the 60-70%
right.
range.
China has touched about 50% now.
Wow.
Yeah. But even countries like smaller countries like Thailand and so on are way higher than that.
Right.
We certainly have a large base. Our aspiration as a country is to get to 50% by 2040, I believe, is what the new education policy states.
Right.
But, you know, there again, if you look at quality GER, so 1 in 4 is enrolled technically,
right.
but 1 in 4 is enrolled in a top 1,000, top 2,000, top 5,000 institution globally. That number would be in single digits, right? And that's the challenge, though. So you are looking at maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 people
right.
going to a quality higher education institution in the
right.
country.
So I suppose, you know, as a nation, these are twin-pronged priorities. On the one hand, you need to raise the base, as it were. So
Correct.
You need the GER to double over the next, 20-odd years. But equally importantly, if we want to create a workforce that is globally competitive, that is, you know, very elite, we also need to raise that percentage in the, say, top 1,000 universities of the world.
Absolutely.
Like people are getting enrolled.
Absolutely.
And what would you say have been the impediments in this journey? What are the factors that are holding us back?
So there are many impediments, but I think the chief impediment is that we've got ourselves locked into a vicious cycle. So this is, you know, different people have different views of what is wrong and what are the impediments. One of the simple impediments is that, you know, education has always been a public good mm-hmm. around the world. And we just haven't had the resources to invest in education. Ashish may have sort of the numbers of what it is in other countries. But one number that is very stark, both for school and college education, is that almost 70% of all education is upwards of 50% on the school side. In terms of numbers and in of institutions and in terms of enrollment is done by the private sector. Ashoka, for example, or ISB are both private institutions. Now, in most countries, you will not find so much private investment in education. Government ends up spending a fair bit of money in terms of resources. We are short of resources in every area in our country, but that's a reality. In nowhere in the history of the human race have you ever had to educate so many people so quickly. And so we are always going to be behind in terms of resources, which is why you need private capital, philanthropy, and so on. But now that private capital is coming in, mm-hmm. I think our regulatory environment has always been focused on inputs rather than outputs. If you look around the world, this has largely been a solved problem where people say, listen, let's look at the quality of graduates that you're graduating. And based on that, I will give you funding. I will qualify you as a top university versus a not so great university. We have been very suspicious of private funding or private universities. So we have created a license mechanism
right.
to say, hey, I will only allow you if you show me these inputs. How many classrooms have you built? How much area do you have? How many bathrooms do you have in the university? Do you meet these standards? Now, those standards are well and good, but that in itself doesn't ensure quality. And there is no mechanism then to say, let's look at quality. We have now put in things like NAC and accreditation and so on. But we hardly get to cover all these institutions that are out there. And in fact, the fact is that we are not able to monitor output. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here and having this conversation.
Yeah.
So despite all the rules that we have, because they are all focused on input,
yeah.
you are really neglecting to measure output and therefore sift out the ones that are not doing so well.
Right.
The last thing I will say is that at the end of the day, we really haven't invested in the soft infrastructure that goes into any education system.
Right.
We need many more faculty, but more importantly, the governance and the leadership of these institutions is extremely important. And I think we'll talk a lot about that today with regard to Ashoka. You need great vice chancellors. You
right.
need great provosts and deans and heads of department. You need educational administrators who are professionally trained. So if you typically see what happens in the West, you know, you become the head of your department. You first become a professor, then you become the head of the department, then you become the dean of the school, then you become the provost. You're sort of groomed for leadership roles. Right. To some extent, that happens here. But appointments in the public universities and so on are not necessarily based on this grooming process, right? Most people who are best fit to play these roles don't apply for these roles. Right. Other people go in. So anyway, I could get into more detail. But the real issue is you need great institutional leaders who need to be trained, groomed, and appointed to these leadership positions based on true merit.
Right.
And not some sort of an automatic process or a selection process that is flawed. And these universities have to be given independence to run. So you fix the output.
Yeah.
And you say, this is the output I need. How you run it, as long as, of course, you're running it within certain boundaries, it's up to you.
Right.
But a lot of universities either become too driven by the government, which is the owner, or some other owner, which is an individual who really doesn't know education or a foundation, even if it's with the right intent, that don't understand what the quality of education should be. And so the governance and leadership again goes for a toss, despite people having resources and the right of it.
Right.
So I think those are some of the factors that are really getting in the way of our being a world-class system.
Right. Normally, or most people, you know, faced with these kind of odds, folks mostly tend to say that, oh, you know, the government is doing a terrible job and what can we do about it? And they throw their, you know, arms up and, you know, sit around. You are among the few who have actually rolled up your sleeves and said, hey, look, let's get out there and try and do something about it. Ashish, I want to hear from you. What is the role that philanthropy has played in building enduring institutions around the world?
Yeah, so I think philanthropy actually can play a very important role. If you go back and look at the U.S., the early philanthropists were Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller. And let's take both of them. I mean, Carnegie built the library system in the U.S., which is a great institution. He founded Carnegie Mellon University. CMU still exists. It's one of the leading institutions for engineering and computer science. Right. And he set up many other institutions, including the National Bureau of Economic Research, which exists to date. I mean, I once counted that he probably built 15 institutions that still exist today. John D. Rockefeller founded the Rockefeller...
How old are these institutions?
He did most of his work 100 years ago.
100 years ago.
100 so years, they've been around for more than 100 years,
more than
actually.
Century, yeah.
And then John D. Rockefeller is another great example. He did some programmatic work. But he soon realized that he needed to institutionalize. And so the Rockefeller University, which is a leading research university, was set up by him, and the University of Chicago as well. So two universities, but a number of other institutions, including the General Education Board, which worked on school education, another organization that worked on public health.
Right.
So I think these early philanthropists in the U.S. realized that programmatic work fizzles away. It doesn't sustain. Mm. And if you had to sustain, you have to institutionalize, whether it's a university, whether it's a public health institution, a museum that's focused on arts and culture, some institutional construct is critical.
When you say programmatic, you're referring to certain limited campaigns or small programs or limited programs.
I think donors often will give to an NGO
right.
for a 3 to 5 year period of time
right.
for some body of work.
Right.
And that body of work then doesn't sustain thereafter.
Right.
And so that's what I mean by fizzles out.
Right.
And that's generally the norm in the philanthropic sector.
Right.
I don't mean all institutionalization has to be for higher ed. It could
sure.
be other forms of institutionalization as well.
Right.
And then in India, we often forget that, you know, some of our early institutions that were set up, including Calcutta University, there were actually local philanthropists that funded buildings or funded particular aspects of the university, even at that point in time. And same is true with many of the colleges of Delhi University, you know, Lady Sri Ram College or yeah. SRCC. There were families that actually helped set up
yeah.
these colleges. So there was
the
always...
Royal families before
royal
that.
Baroda,
slew of,
you know. So there has been private participation. in building institutions, even in the Indian context. And then for a while with, you know, the new India being born, independent India, really the state took over and did a great job setting up the IITs, IIMs. As we moved towards more of a preponderance of professional degrees in India, focused on engineering and other disciplines, we had a slew of private universities come up where the real desire was not not-for-profit, but it was really to make money, more crass commercialism. They've done a good job in scaling up. And so for a while, the private sector participation was on, around massification, not around building quality. It's in the more recent past, really with ISB starting about 20 years ago, that there was this idea of, you know, private philanthropic capital coming together to build a quality institution. And ISB, of course, is focused just on one vertical, so building a business school. And subsequently, we've seen, as you mentioned earlier, in the last decade, many private universities come up that are philanthropic in nature, which have higher aspirations. So I think in India, it started. Yeah. And really, this in the U.S., if you look at all the leading private universities, they've been built on the back of philanthropic capital. Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Chicago, all of them. I think the new set that are emerging in India could very well, alongside some of the leading public institutions, 10, 15, 20 years from now, be amongst the top 10, 20 universities in India.
You know, I was wondering about the compounding effect, I suppose, of institution building. To think that the University of Chicago, which is one of, you know, several institutions that Carnegie founded, I think the economics department at Chicago alone today boasts of some 8 or 9 Nobel Prizes, you know. So they, I mean, what these can become over time is quite remarkable indeed. But Ashish, isn't this, you know, very large and enduring institutions with mega endowments, isn't that private endowments, isn't that a uniquely North American phenomenon? I mean, if you look at Europe or, you know, most other parts of the world, isn't higher education dominated by institutions set up by the state?
Yeah, I mean, look, in Europe, there are more state-led institutions. There are fewer examples of private philanthropy. I think in America, private philanthropy definitely took off and really funded these institutions over the last 100, 150 years, although the early institutions were set up as early as almost 400 years ago. I think there are examples, though, in the emerging world. If you look across Turkey, Brazil, other countries in Asia, where there's been private philanthropy that's come together to set up new universities, East Asia has been a little different, much like Europe, where, again, the state has played a more dominant role, especially in China and Singapore and Hong Kong. So I think it really depends on the local circumstance. And in some cases, it's a mixed model, where there are great public universities and private ones as well.
Right. And could you survey the landscape for us in India? Like, you know, this remarkable cohort of private universities with a lot of aspirations that have come up in the last decade or so, and most of them are a work in progress. Could you do a survey, like, which are the interesting ones, which are the notable ones? What is the landscape like?
Yeah. So I think Ashoka clearly has been a pioneer in, you know, interdisciplinary higher education. And that was our model when we started a decade ago. Jindal University started a little bit before Ashoka and has a great law school, some other programs, and then later followed with interdisciplinary education as well. Mm-hmm. Shivnadar University started with an engineering school, a management school, I think really expanded the humanities, social sciences thereafter. So they're a full university now. Azim Premji University in the south started with a stronger focus on the development sector, mm-hmm. but has expanded now, again, to humanities, social sciences, and the fundamental sciences. Kriya is a university in the south that covers all these domains as well. FLAME was a college earlier,
yeah.
and then really upgraded to a university,
yeah.
A few years ago.
Right.
And so they are a player as well.
Right.
Ahmedabad University, really, what they did is they subsumed some existing colleges. Mm-hmm. And they've now got a university that covers actually some professional degrees as well, mm-hmm. in addition to the humanities, social sciences, and the fundamental sciences. And there's Plaksha now up in Mohali that's focused more on engineering. Mm-hmm. So I think there's about a 10 or so mm-hmm. of these private universities that have come up. Of course, BITS Pilani.
The BITS OG. The original great.
The original, yeah. If you look at the private ones,
yeah.
BITS stood head and shoulders above the others. Yeah. And it's been philanthropic.
Right.
It's different from the others in terms of its intent.
Right, right. All of them are of varying sizes in terms of funds and budgets and all of that.
Yeah, somewhat different.
Right.
And everybody has their own unique focus as well.
Right.
Some are very broad and want to cover everything.
Right.
Azim Premji University is quite broad.
Right.
But I think has a focus on, you know, producing leaders who will go and have an impact on the ground.
Right.
And definitely has more of a focus of the overall foundation, which
right.
is on justice and being a humane society.
Right.
So it's more development oriented.
Right.
Ashoka, as I mentioned earlier, the big focus was on interdisciplinarity and really high-quality research and now the sciences. Jindal has more professional schools and has got a couple of innovative programs, including public policy, mm-hmm. in addition to law. So every one of these has a slightly different flavor,
mm-hmm.
although I think all of them will evolve into full universities over time.
I have to say, you know, I completely by chance, I happened to visit Flame University in Pune and a really, really impressive space, you know, large campus, the facilities for sports. I mean, the buildings, I think it was designed by B.K. Doshi.
Yeah.
Very reminiscent of the IIMs, you know, and lovely, lovely. I mean, what infrastructure.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful location as well. And I think that's the lovely thing about all these universities.
Right.
And of course, I think the software is more important than the hardware.
Sure.
But they are making an effort as well to build world-class infrastructure.
Absolutely.
And to provide the facilities not just for academics.
Yeah.
But also for athletics, for
Absolutely.
Other student activities, co-curricular, which includes theater, dance, you know, many other forms of education beyond the academics.
Right, right. Pramod, let me come to you. Let's talk a little bit about the founding of ISB. And so in some sense, Ashoka is your second major venture in education. You were the moving force behind the founding of ISB. Talk us through that project a little bit. How was the inception? How did you start? What were your learnings in setting it up?
I think one of the big things that exemplify ISB's founding, which we have taken to the next level in the Ashoka founding, has really been the collective philanthropy and the collective governance and leadership model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that even though Ashish mentioned a number of these other institutions, I think there we are truly unique.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the coming together or one or a few people orchestrating and getting together a bunch of philanthropists
mm-hmm.
with very common intent and vision,
mm-hmm.
and then also deferring to the collective vision
rather
than just using that as a sort of fig leaf or to show.
Yeah.
Has been the defining thing that I learned from that experience, which we've carried on here. So, in fact, when you say your venture, none of these are my ventures.
Sure.
And, of course, I've had just the opportunity to be part of these.
Sure.
But, frankly, this was nobody's venture. And I still go back to the early days of ISB when, to consulting fashion, we said, so what makes great universities, right? And so we started to do a benchmarking of things around the world.
Right.
And you came up with the usual stuff, you know, teaching, research, reputation. But one of the curious things we found was none of the great universities were owned by anyone.
Right, right. Yeah.
So Rockefeller's name is not even on Chicago.
Absolutely. Carnegie's, I didn't know at all. That.
Right.
Yeah.
And Carnegie's name may be there, but it's really Carnegie Mellon. And there is no Carnegie sitting on the board of trustees today. In fact, it's actually run probably by some alums who are distinguished over time. So this model that no one, whether one person or one institution or one foundation owns, even if it's non-profit, and therefore doesn't play a dominant role in decision-making.
Right.
And that yet, everybody owns. So whoever's part of it feels a really strong sense of ownership, whether it's a student, current, whether it's an alumnus, whether it's a faculty member, it's a staff member, and whether it's a board member, feels passionately about the fact that they're building something that they can, you know, leave behind as a legacy. Is that powerful emotion, culture, sense of purpose that you need to capture? And I think we've been able to do that in both these institutions. Mm-hmm. The other thing that ISB had in its DNA, and we've got that in Ashoka's DNA also, is a belief that sitting here in India, mm-hmm. with all of the things that you talked about, and you mentioned the earlier before you started talking to Ashish, that despite all these problems, you started to go out and do this, is the belief that you can, sitting here, build a truly high-quality, world-class, pioneering institution from day one. Mm-hmm. So what most people do is they think, let's start small. Doesn't matter if the quality is not great. Maybe we'll get the few faculty who are retirees or who are available in Delhi. Let's get started with that. And over time, because there is so much demand, there is no end, we'll definitely get there. Someday we will become top class. I think our realization in that study that we did was that to start at tier 3 or B grade and then try to become tier 1 or A grade is a almost impossible task. In fact, very few people have been able to do that in short order. It would certainly not happen in our lifetimes.
That's so interesting. So the die is cast.
Yes.
When you, you know, when you start that way.
You get stuck at a particular level because you've got a certain quality of faculty, you've got a certain level of students. And then if you want to change the engines while the plane is flying, it's almost impossible because, you know, you've got the students for 4 years. Other students who are smarter or brighter will say, well, that's not the place my classmates went when they were toppers. Faculty are even more cliquish when it comes to that, right? They'll say, like, listen, I don't deserve to be in this place, right? I want to go to a better place. So I think that realization, and, you know, one of the people who actually taught me this was Don Jacobs, who was the dean of Kellogg. 50 years ago, Kellogg was not known as a top B school. People knew the brand name of the cereal more than the graduate school. Don Jacobs became the dean of Kellogg, and it almost took him 25, 30 years to take Kellogg to where it went to, which is amongst the top 2-3 in the world. And he talked about the fact that, you know, it's not easy. If you look at INSEAD, which when we were growing up, INSEAD was not a top school. But it's now become one of the... And you read the history of INSEAD. INSEAD was actually founded almost 100 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yes. And they started with executive education programs with Harvard faculty coming to France to teach exec ed under the equivalent of a FICCI or a CII in France. Right. Their MBA program only started in the late 60s. And it's taken them... So if you can see example after example that once you set a standard, taking the bar up is a lifelong journey. It can be 2-3 generations. So one of the things, to cut a long story short, that we started and we said this about ISB and we did this at Ashoka is, listen, from day one, we have to put in the building blocks as if we are a top 10, top 100, top-notch university. We will not make compromises because then we'll be set back and we'll never get there. Now, having that confidence from day one did take some doing, right? And that's really one of the big things that defines the DNA of these institutions. Finally, one last thing I will say. See, there's no dearth of students in India. And as we have known, you know, Ashish went from Calcutta to Yale. I went from Patna to Kanpur to Philadelphia. You know, we'll go anywhere for a good education, right, that you can get in. The real thing that defines a good education is faculty, at least in the Indian context, because there are enough bright students you'll get. So you want to learn from the best. So if you just, if there was one factor, if there was one lever that you pulled, it has to be the faculty lever. You can build the best infrastructure and not have good faculty, and then you're stuck. Or you don't need infrastructure, you bring in the best faculty, put them under a tree, and it'll happen. And that's what happened with us. With Ashoka, we started with the Young India Fellowship Program and we didn't even have a campus. We rented an auditorium in an existing institution. We placed our students in Katwariya Sarai in a hostel and we were up and running. But the 25 faculty who taught the students in that very first year were absolutely top-notch. And that set the bar from day one.
You know, what you're saying about this is so interesting because in almost anything else we think about, whether it is in building, a company or in, starting a publication, you always think that, okay, let's start and iteratively you can become better, right? And indeed, that's possible in those kind of things. But in university, it's different.
Quality doesn't scale.
Yeah.
No, quality, and also you're right. I mean, like if you remember when we were growing up, Lucky Gold Star was a terrible brand.
Right.
Today, LG is an aspirational brand. You know, it's the same company. It's just grown up. The products have become much better.
Yeah.
I think with higher ed, it's very different because it gets etched in the minds of students, faculty, parents, counselors, principals.
Recruiters.
Yeah. And then you're caught in that cycle. Either it's a virtuous cycle or a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. It's one reason why education brands also live longer.
Mm.
You can sometimes be weak on the inside, but just the very fact that you have a brand means the best students will still come. They'll graduate. And that in itself will bring in the next cohort of great students, you know.
You know, this is a very important point that Ashish is making. And you see that in the hierarchy of the IIMs and the IITs in this country. Right? So IIM A, B, C are up there. You know, Kozhikode, Indore, Lucknow will keep trying.
Yeah.
But they will always be seen as.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So when we set up ISB Mohali,
right,
we were very clear that from day one, we will not allow that to happen.
Right.
Because suddenly you will now be slotted as a
Hyderabad versus Mohali.
And a second-rate campus relative to Hyderabad. And you will never get out of that
rut.
So we had the same admissions process. We have the same recruiting process. You cannot differentiate between the two campuses. Otherwise, you'll get stuck forever.
Right. Let's now come to the founding of Ashoka University. Ashish, could you take us through the origin story, as it were? How did the idea begin? What was the initial group of folks that came together? How did you believe that you could raise a very substantial sum to found a large project like this?
Yeah, so actually this group came together about 15 years ago. And there were some early conversations, two sets of people. I think there were a bunch of former IITians who wanted to build a broad university.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group of Stephanians, Sanjeev Bikchandani and a few others, who wanted to really create a new college, as it were, if Stevens were the old college. All roads led to Pramath Sinha, because he was the founding dean of the ISB, a person many of us knew who had been involved in the higher education sector. And so this group eventually whittled down, and really it was a few of us, Pramath and myself included, and by 2010 is when we got really serious, because there was a new education city being formed in Haryana, and there was the opportunity to buy land. We had scouted land in many other places, but we figured being located in NCR was something that would work well. It's a great hub for faculty, and given that all of us are here, we'd actually be able to provide some oversight as well, visit the campus, be involved, etc. So we jumped at the opportunity when this came up in Haryana, and we put up the initial capital to purchase 25 acres of land.
And this was really in 2010.
And that's really when the, you know, because, I mean, till then it's a bunch of conversations.
Right.
But it's when you really put the money down that it's real serious intent.
No. But at that point, did you have any sense of, had you guys decided what is the scale of this project going to be? How much money would you have to raise eventually?
No, honestly, we would have grossly underestimated it.
Right.
We initially thought, Sanjeev Bikchandani jokes, he thought it was 25 crore, but I think he's being facetious.
Sure.
We thought that the initial amount would be about 500 crore.
To
build the first campus.
Right.
right, on 25 acres. But we got going with a much smaller amount. We were entrepreneurial because we said, let's first purchase the land. Mm-hmm. Let's get started. We broke it up into four phases.
Okay.
So the first phase, we started construction in 2012. So there was the campus development, all the approvals with regards to becoming a full university that were in full swing. We eventually became a university in 2014. Mm-hmm. Pramath alluded to this earlier, that we actually started the Young India Fellowship.
Yeah.
Which is a one-year non-degree program, a post-grad program.
Yeah.
Very different. There was nothing like it. Very innovative in that it provided someone who was graduating in engineering from the IITs or some other place, even St. Stephen's, with a broad education which they hadn't received. And we weren't sure if there would be demand for this. So in the first year, we went around to many campuses, pitched the idea. About 900 students applied, and the initial cohort was only 57. So what Pramath said earlier, being extremely selective with students, 25 great faculty who taught in that initial program, and we raised money to fund the program. So the initial funding was really for the land. Sanjeev and I put in the money initially for the land, and then we really crowdsourced money from some friends for the YIF first year cohort. Mm-hmm. And then we did it year by year. The next year, we had actually scaled the program to 100 students. The cost per student came down, and we were able to raise more scholarships. Mm-hmm. Whatever deficit there was, many of us put in over and above that scholarship amount to actually fund. So there was some stability. By the third year, which now we're talking 2013, the third year of the YIF, we had 3,000 applications for 100 spots.
Right.
So it had already become a very prestigious program, a 3% selection rate.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I saw an article in the press that called it the Rhodes for India.
Mm.
So to Pramath's point again, I think the idea was, you know, to build a really prestigious program that was a precursor, in a way, to Ashoka.
Yeah.
And 2014 is the first year we became a full university.
Uh-huh.
So we had started to recruit full-time faculty. Uh-huh. Till then, it was all visiting faculty coming in for the Young India Fellowship in 2013, getting ready for 2014. We launched our undergraduate programs in 2014, BA, BSc, across the humanities and social sciences initially. By then, we also started reaching out to more philanthropists to come in as core partners in the project. So it wasn't just a small ticket funding for scholarships in the YIF. We also were now constructing, you know, a much bigger campus. And so a core group came together to fund the initial university. Many of them are currently our trustees and governing body members. Many of them have stepped up and contributed much more over time. So in all earnestness, our fundraising process really started after we became a full university. And that's when we started to pull many other people into the project. Before, it was just fund a scholarship here or there. We then, with the undergraduate program, very quickly, the first year was just 130 students. But very quickly, we created a very aspirational brand. And I think one of the reasons is because Ashoka was a pioneer for a new form of education in India. Interdisciplinary students could choose the subject. You could do a major, minor. There was a lot of flexibility in the program, and of course the quality of faculty. You know, many of these were folks who had graduated from PhD programs at leading universities, top universities in the US, the UK, etc., who'd come back. And the fact that we had fantastic, you know, philanthropists, leaders who had funded the institution, and people were confident that this was going to succeed based on the first 10, 20 people they saw associated with the university. Because it's a big risk for parents to send their sons or daughters initially to Ashoka. And many of the leading school principals in India, I think, somehow got the confidence very early on in 2014, 2015 itself to start to recommend Ashoka. So we got off to a good start with a very distinctive value proposition. We were pioneers, as I mentioned, a different form of education. And then in 2017, we expanded into the sciences. We also offer computer science, mathematics, etc. And so if you now look at in 2022, we've scaled up quite a bit from our first cohort in 2011 of 57 students. That's all we had. We had no degree programs. We had no campus.
So now, why was a one-year
program? Yeah, run out of a rented campus in Delhi.
Yeah.
So from that point in 2011, where it was 57 students, zero acreage, zero square feet. It is all just a rented campus. To now, we have 2,600 students.
Wow.
They come from 300 towns and cities across India. We get applications from 40 countries outside India.
Wow.
Across Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, Southeast Asia. 55% of the students are women, half of them on financial aid. So that's the student side. We have almost
half of all students are on financial aid.
That's right. We have 200 faculty, about 60 of whom are visiting, and 140 are full-time at Ashoka now. And we've built 1.5 million square feet of buildings. We have several buildings already, residential, academic, sports, the whole sort of campus is up and running. We have raised in the first phase over 1,500 crore, which funded the first 10 years, what we call the startup phase of Ashoka. 160 plus founders and over 200 donors.
Yeah. What's the difference between founders and donors?
So founders are those who've committed 2 crore and above.
Okay.
And donors could have contributed a smaller amount.
And among the founders, what would be roughly the median ticket size of their donations?
The median would still be around sub 10 crore. So the average would be higher.
Right.
The average would be north of 10 crore, the median would be probably sub 5 crore even.
Okay.
Because we do have a few large donors.
Right.
Who would skew that skew average, the numbers. Yeah.
Do you want to mention them? Or do you talk about this? Or who are the large donors who have, very substantially given to the university?
I think there are many. I mean, there are many. I think it's more that we have a number of people invested in the idea of Ashoka. So it's not just 4 or 5, but really out of the 160, I would say 30, 40 are quite actively involved.
Right.
But all 160 feel passionate about the cause.
Right.
And I think that's a remarkable part of the story.
Right.
So in this first decade, really what we've achieved is the idea of being able to attract fantastic faculty from around the world to come here, many of whom, if Ashoka didn't exist, wouldn't have come back to India.
Mm.
We've managed to get some of the best philanthropists around the table and a governance structure. We can talk more about that.
Yeah.
That's been effective. And we have, I believe, one of the best undergraduate programs outside of the technical education or professional education in the country today. Truly aspirational and one that's inclusive. And we've set the ball rolling as far as research is concerned. I would say we've got a long journey ahead.
Sure.
But given the quality of people we have on board, they already are producing very high-quality research, but we haven't achieved critical mass as yet.
Ashish, help me understand the financial engineering that goes into something like this, right? One is that you need to raise money to spend, to develop the buildings, to pay the faculty and so on. But you also have to simultaneously build up an endowment, which makes sure that, which makes sure the university sustains in perpetuity. And then how does... you also make some income from the operation of the university. So how does all of that work?
Correct. So let me say that firstly, from an income standpoint, we don't break even as yet. We have so far cumulatively had about 200 crore of losses. Last year, because of COVID, and that's pre-depreciation. If you include depreciation, the losses are 300 crore plus. Last year, we would have broken even pre-depreciation if it were not for COVID. But we had to give up hostel revenue because we couldn't charge students if they were not going to be on campus. Our aspiration is that the P&L should break even, the teaching P&L. We really break up our P&L into two.
Okay.
The teaching P&L includes faculty cost. It funds the undergraduate program, funds the master's program. That should break even. It should stand on its own feet. The research P&L, we will have to fund out of the endowment and out of money we raise on an ongoing basis. That includes PhD program, postdocs, and certain other research costs. Obviously, you get a multiplier effect in that you seed some research programs, and then eventually the faculty go out and raise many multiples of that from with extramural funding or with DST, DBT, other forms of funding coming in. So the research enterprise, we don't cover through the teaching PNL. Then the land building, we fund through philanthropic resources. And that we will continue to do going forward. The endowment is something we don't have as yet. We do keep a buffer. You can call it a sort of endowment.
Sure.
But in terms of a true endowment, we don't have one as yet. And when we talk about the next phase of Ashoka, it's a critical component of the next phase.
I want to talk about the next phase of Ashoka University's development. But before that, let's take a moment to go back to the times when you were students in the U.S. As Pramath mentioned, both of you went from, you know, an Indian setting, an Indian education to very elite universities in the U.S. When that happened and when you landed stateside and when you first tasted the American university education system, what were your thoughts? What stood out? And, you know, did you feel that, gosh, this is so different from what we have back home?
I felt like I'd been liberated.
Right.
You know, I was stuck in a, I was a good student.
Yeah.
But I was stuck in a system which was all about rote. It was textbook focused.
Yeah.
It was sage on stage, you know, in terms of the professor lecturing, taking notes. It was about
sage
exams.
On stage, okay.
Yeah, it was about exams.
Right.
And when I went to the U.S., and I had no choice. I was a PCMB student, so I was just studying science and math. And even if I wanted to study history in 11th and 12th grade or economics or something, or philosophy, I couldn't take a course, and I didn't get exposed to that. So I, in a sense, I was liberated because I wasn't 100% sure. I mean, I was a science student, so I had an inclination towards the sciences, but I wasn't sure. So firstly, the ability to go to Yale and to be able to switch, to be able to explore. So the first year itself, I took a wide range of courses in psychology, economics, mathematics, sciences, the humanities, you know, literature, etc. And I finally decided that I wanted to major in mathematics and economics. I did take a number of courses in history as well, because I loved history. So the opportunity to sort of mix and match eventually, even when I decided what I wanted to major in, and to be able to take some eclectic courses. I mean, I learned Spanish when I was in college. That stayed with me forever, a love for Latin America and for Spanish culture. I, you know, got exposed to China. There was a wonderful course taught by Jonathan Spence in the history of modern China. It got me interested in the history of China, the development of China, East Asia, etc. So many of those are very formative experiences, really, because of the idea of a broad education. And then really what, you know, because not every course had an exam, you're really forced to think. You participated in class. It was a Socratic method. You wrote papers. You had to think critically. You had to learn how to write, to communicate well. And you developed a real love for learning. I was like a kid in a candy store.
Right.
Because I had a lot of choice.
Right.
And learning was fun. It was exciting. I was reading, you know, for a course, many books. It wasn't just one textbook. And, you know, that excitement about learning, that curiosity, stayed with me forever. But it opened up a lot of vistas as well in terms of, you know, different ways of thinking. So when I became an investor later in my life, I always say, you know, the math or the accounting or the analyzing balance sheets, lots of people can do.
Yeah.
But what makes you a good investor is to be a student of business cycles, to be able to really understand markets over a 100-year period of time.
Right.
And to study them, and even economic cycles, even companies and industries over a long period of time. And to be a student of psychology, to be able to understand the psychology of markets, your own psychology, how you control your emotions, how you right. behave, how you act, what your principles are, etc. And sort of the ethics around this as well, which comes from philosophy. And the ability to communicate well, because if you can't communicate well, write well, you can't raise money. So you need all of these things, apart from just economics and math and accounting
right.
and finance,
right.
to be a good investor. And I think all of those came together for me in my profession as well.
How wonderful. Pramath, your experience?
Very similar.
Right.
But interestingly, in fact, much more hard-hitting in the sense that I had come out of IIT.
Right. You went to IIT Kharagpur.
Kanpur.
Kanpur, right.
And I didn't know better till I went to Penn that there was a whole different way of learning.
Mm.
So in fact, what had happened was that while externally you felt very proud that you had gone to an IIT, wherever you went, everybody said, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right? And even in IIT, you saw all your classmates and they were off the charts,
of course.
Smart.
Yeah, yeah.
You really didn't know what you were doing in the sense that I was studying metallurgical engineering in which I had really no interest.
Right.
And I was doing that because I wanted to be in Kanpur. In those days, Kanpur was the most coveted of the campuses.
I see.
I was from Patna. A lot of school friends had gone to Kanpur.
Right.
My brother-in-law had gone to Kanpur. So you had to go to Kanpur. And then once you pick the place, then your rank in the JEE decides what you study.
Yeah.
And I was counseled, quote unquote, to study metallurgical engineering because I could get a job in the steel industry and work in TISCO or SAIL.
What a disappointment you've turned out to be, you know?
Absolutely. And I thought I was done with engineering and academia.
Right.
I never thought I would. Now, to Kanpur's credit and to the IIT system's credit, two of my professors in my final year said, don't take that software job. And guess what? I actually had a software job coming out of metallurgy. Which is the other positive thing about our education was that because Kanpur was set up with MIT support, we had a DEC system 1090 computer. Earlier, the IBM computers had come and they had always had a computer center. So we were all taught how to program.
Oh, nice.
And so it did have elements of a liberal education, you know, the breadth of engineering disciplines.
Yeah.
That one course changed my life because I got a job in the software industry, but then I also was able to work on a BTEC project that involved a lot of programming. And one of the professors who was working with me was a recent PhD from Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, listen, I can't study more. I'm no good at this. I hate metallurgy. And he says, why don't you switch disciplines? I said, really, is that even possible? And he said, yeah, why don't we try Penn? And I said, okay. And sure enough, Penn admitted me into mechanical engineering. But then I was a kid in a candy store too. When I showed up there and I went to register for courses, I still remember Elaine Blatt, who was a graduate student, academic assistant or whatever. I asked her, what should I register for? And she said, you can take whatever you want. I said, what do you mean? I mean, I'm here for a master's and I should be choosing certain courses. And she said, no, there are two requirements. You can do it anytime. There's a M.Tech project you have to do. But other than that, you can pick any course. I said, well, can I pick a course in the medical school? And she said, yeah, you can do that. I said, what about the Wharton School? Because, you know, all of us in India knew about Wharton, MBA. And she said, listen, that's a little bit tricky because those courses are for the MBA students. But if the professor allows you and there's a spot in the class, absolutely. And guess what I did? I was always enamored by new things. So I took a course in robotics and a course in computer vision. The computer vision was taught by a woman who was the head of the computer science department. I just loved what she was doing. And she became my PhD advisor. And I'm still in touch with her. She's 88 years old. I see her all the time, writing a biography of her.
You were writing a biography?
Yes, I'm getting a biography or written about her.
Do you want to mention her name?
Yeah, Professor Ruzhina Baichi.
Okay.
Who's an icon in the field of computer vision.
So she taught you computer vision in which year?
1989.
Yeah.
And I pursued her. And I'm going to this other aspect where it's not just the flexibility of courses.
Mm-hmm.
The commitment of every professor and every staff member to make you successful is remarkable.
Mm.
And that's the culture. So what happened is, just to give you an example,
sure.
I was a mechanical engineering student technically.
Yeah.
I wanted to do my PhD with her because I said, okay, suddenly what happened was all my creative juices and my academic juices started coming back.
Right.
And I said, no, I want to do this. I want to work for this woman only. I want to do research in this only. I never thought I had that. but it was the atmosphere that created. When I went to her, she said, listen, you're wasting your time with me. I'm a computer scientist. The technical thing is if you do a PhD under me, you'll have to switch to computer science. You'll have to learn all the computer science disciplines. You'll have to pass your preliminary examinations in computer science. It'll be a waste of time. I said, but, you know, somehow I just want to do this. She went to the mechanical engineering department. She sat down with my department guys who didn't care two hoots for what I was doing or what she was doing. The silos were even there in those days, despite all the interdisciplinarity. Convinced that the way to solve the problem is to actually put mechanical engineers from that department on my PhD committee. And I'm getting into some technical details
here,
only to tell you
that
she made the effort that made it possible for me to be the only ever mechanical engineering student in the history of her career who's been a PhD student for her. She went out of the way to do that. And it's simple things like that that completely endear you to that system. And this is what Ashish and I try to keep doing at Ashoka, right?
That was the first part of this immersive conversation with Pramath and Ashish. The second part of this conversation drops next week. Stay tuned. That's it from me for this episode. You've been listening to The Sketch. This episode was edited by Devina Sengupta. Deepthi Ahuja is the producer of this show and our audio editor is Sanju Abraham. You can email us with your thoughts on thesketch@livemint.com. For more updates on this podcast, follow HT Smartcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube and LinkedIn. To listen to more such Mint podcasts, log on to htsmartcast.com. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.